You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Tuesday, April 20th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. Carl Hart, the chair of the Department of Psychology and the Dirk Ziff Professor of Psychology at Columbia University, author of Drug Use for Grownups, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. Meanwhile, the Derek Chauvin trial heads to the jury, or I should say remains with the jury. We don't know when to expect a verdict, but it could literally come any moment. Global COVID infections number hit a record high. The Capitol police officer who died the day after the attack on the Capitol, his death now ruled by stroke and natural causes and not at the hands of those Capitol rioters. A lot of questions remain as to why we heard those initial reports and why they were wrong. Florida passes a bill that will make it a lot easier to run over protesters. White House to prepare a near $1 trillion set of proposals for family-oriented benefits, basically the second tranche of the infrastructure bill. Meanwhile, Republicans and business leaders are at odds over the tiny corporate tax increase that President Joe Manchin has proposed. Progressives in the House offer a $100 billion bill to upgrade public housing. And lastly, rest in peace, Walter Mondale, the vice president to Jimmy Carter, and one of the few biographies I read back in high school. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. With me, of course, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, a Walter Mondale fan?
I was...
Walter Mondale fan, 420.
Very much on brand for me to have read. That's why I felt like I had to.
Sorry for doxing you. Yeah.
I did read his biography. It was, I don't know. That's what I was into. Really not terribly flashy politicians back in the day.
How was it?
I don't remember it.
Yeah, what stuck with you?
Just the cover, which just was a picture of him. That was it.
I think
the fact that I read that biography stuck with me more than what was in it.
Right.
But there it is. Yes. And it's a 420 day. We won't go into the maybe we'll wait a little bit before we get into the specifics of 420. What was your favorite biography that you read when you were in high school?
I mean, there were a lot of dorky ones.
Did Lawrence Taylor have one at that time?
No, I read a lot of historical figure biographies. Autobiographies, but a lot of Lincoln ones. My dog was named Lincoln. I named him Lincoln when I was a kid. He was a black dog. Lincoln used to dress in all black, and that's why I named him Lincoln. I really liked Abraham Lincoln. Now let's move on.
All right, there we go.
I have to take it if I'm going to give it to you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This is Anatoly Dobrynin's In Confidence. So that's my...
That's what you read in junior high.
I read it in college, but I probably shouldn't have.
Okay. College is a different story, but
oh yeah, college I got much more more interesting. More sophisticated. Yeah, then I read Paul Tsongas's biography. All right. Speaking of history and Reformation tours, we've been inundated with John Boehner's Reformation tour. And there seems to be an ongoing project to try and make the Republican Party. And to some extent, this is completely predictable. Like the idea that they were going to attempt, and it's been hard because I think so much of the active Republican Party is still clinging to Donald Trump with an incredible measure of desperation. But there are people who are trying to, you know, they're worried about their legacy. And George Bush is coming out there and trying to distance himself from the Republican Party of today. And so much of what George Bush did in his 8 years and the Republicans at that time were the precursor to this, that it's almost grotesque to see him sort of now deified. There's a certain amount of, you know, this happens all the time. Even when Nixon died, there was some sort of reformation project. Same with Ronald Reagan. Here is George Bush on the Today Show today, saying he's just a simple painter. And basically, the two of them here are talking about this hypothetical Republican politician who's going to possibly, you know, save the Republican Party.
If you were to describe the Republican Party as you see it today,
yeah,
how would you describe it?
I would describe it as isolationist, protectionist, and to a certain extent, nativist.
Pause it for 1 second. The isolationist, of course, he's saying because they didn't want to engage in the wars that I did. I mean, let's remember, we are now just preparing to leave the 20-year war that George Bush started in Afghanistan.
Which later in the interview, by the way, he expressed skepticism for us withdrawing because what about the women and girls of Afghanistan?
And Sam? Look, that is a not a completely illegitimate concern, but one which he had much opportunity to address. Except for he, when we were there, he turned to Iraq. If he thought there was any chance for anything other than a completely open-ended, permanent presence in that country, that chance was 17, 18 years ago.
Just the faux concern for, the United States funded religious fundamentalism back in the day in Afghanistan, and now, look, the consequences of religious fundamentalism, and let me use that as an excuse to continue
even
to
if
occupy
I take
this
him,
country.
Even yeah, if okay. I take him at face value, though, even I, if I take him at sincerity, he's
we
still, well, I mean, that I don't know what's in his heart, but I do know what he did, and I do know what he did not do. Exactly. I don't know what's in his heart. The idea that that this party is nativist and was not in any way promoted by him I still remember him playing to the same crew of people, but at that time demonizing gay people by saying that we needed going on national television in the middle of the, prime time and saying with a really heavy heart that he's going to have to push for a constitutional amendment to prevent gay people from marrying.
He's a saint, though, just a simple painter.
Simple painter. Continue.
Nativist.
Are you disappointed?
Well, it's not exactly my vision. Yeah. But you know what? I'm just an old guy they put out to pasture. So just a simple painter.
The simple painter. Okay, let me give you a hypothetical candidate for 2024.
Okay,
this hypothetical Republican is pro-immigration, pro a path to citizenship for undocumented workers,
yeah,
pro DACA, pro-reasonable gun control,
yeah,
pro-education funding for public schools. Does that person have a shot, or that Republican, would that Republican have a shot in 2024?
Sure, yeah.
You think?
I think so. I think that it depends upon the emphasis. I think if the emphasis is integrity and decency and trying to work to get problems solved, I think the person has a shot, yeah.
Mm-hmm. It seems like you've...
By the way, I think pro-immigration isn't the right way to put it. I think border enforcement with a compassionate touch.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
That's how I would put it.
All right, that's a good
one. Pro-immigration basically means let's just open up the borders, and nobody's really for that. And right. You can't have a country that has open borders.
So you're just in lockstep with a majority of the Republican Party, but just with a compassionate touch.
You give them a muffin basket.
Yeah.
Send them home, and you give them mugs with Uncle Sam on it. Send them home. You know what's interesting about this is that's how he won.
Yeah.
He won by being folksy, by saying compassionate conservatism, and making it about CEO president. And hiding the entire Republican agenda, which, consisted of tax cuts and then essentially invading other countries. And at that time, a deep amount of homophobia.
Yeah, that's not his vision, right? The isolationist part, not his vision. He would prefer just a little touch of more imperialism.
Indeed. All right, we got to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Dr. Carl Hart, chair of the Department of Psychology and the Dirk Ziff Professor of Psychology at Columbia University, author of Drug Use for Grownups, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. But before we do, just a reminder, today is 420, April 20th, and SunsetLakeCBD.com has their ongoing 420 sale, and it lasts until April 23rd. I don't know the logic of that, but that's the case. And folks can use the coupon code 420 and get 30% off their entire purchase. That means 30% off of tinctures, gummies, hemp flower, the chocolate fudge, which I've gotten an email today from a listener saying unbelievable.
Very good.
And all of our other CBD products. Use code 420 for 30% off. The sale ends on April 23rd. Don't miss out. Don't forget, they also have, this is going to be a little bit embarrassing, the CBD dog biscuits. They sent me some. They are blended with CBD oil with three simple ingredients, peanut butter, pumpkin, and oat flour, to create a delicious biscuit designed to comfort your four-legged friend. The treats have 5 milligrams of CBD. They contain no artificial flavorings or sweeteners. I tried one.
You should have did it on air.
I should have tried. I will. It's, you know, they're not.
Was it accidental?
No.
Oh, that's worse.
They sent them, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to try one.
My significant other has given CBD dog treats, and they work to the dogs, not to the, you know.
Well, you should try one, too.
Yeah.
Because they're not bad. Folks, the CBD from Sunset Lake CBD has been fantastic, very helpful for me, particularly in terms of sleeping. But also recreationally, I use it occasionally. You can go to sunsetlakescbd.com, and for 3 more days, use the code 420. You get 30% off. Check it out. All right. Want to welcome back to the program Dr. Carl Hart. He is a professor of psychology at Columbia University. He's the author of Drug Use for Grownups, Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. Professor, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm here with Emma Vigeland, and I think it's been, I think 8 years since the last book, I think we have seen you. Appreciate your coming. This book is in some respects a little bit of a memoir, a little bit of a treatise. But let's start with just sort of what your own personal experience on what led you to write this book.
Yeah, so you said you correctly said that it's a bit of a memoir, but that's just to make sure that the reader know whose hands they're in. I wanted the reader to know my story, and I wanted the reader to know that they were in the hands of an expert when it comes to drugs. And so I had to say something about my personal story. The thing that led me to write this book is my travels around the globe. In those travels, I noticed something became very evident and clear. The majority of people who use drugs, the ones that we vilify, are middle class, middle to upper class, well-to-do, typically white folks around the world. But yet, that's not the people who we oftentimes associate drug use with. These people are responsible, they meet their obligations, they are captains of industry, they're people who we respect. But yet they're all in the closet. I mean, they are these hyper-responsible people, but then they behave like children when it comes to drugs. They don't tell anybody, they lie about this behavior, and they don't fight for their right to put whatever they want in their bodies. And I was struck by that. Meanwhile, we are vilifying these people who have limited resources for that, for engaging in that behavior. It's like, something's wrong here. And so being a person who studies drugs, I thought like, well, I have to say something about this and I have to at least act like a responsible person. So get out of the closet, encourage other people to do the same and expose this nonsense.
And so what is the nonsense about how we leverage drugs? I mean, you talk about some of the history of race and drugs in this country going back to post-Civil War, when we were talking about opium, when it came to Chinese workers and cocaine in the first couple of decades of the 20th century relative to black folk. Drugs have been a mechanism in which society sort of has leveraged drugs in some ways for race. I mean, like, it's not necessarily the attack on drugs as much as it is the attack on different people.
Yeah, you know, so let's just use American racism as a backdrop. That's just who we have been. And drugs is just another tool. So think of it in that way. So when we think about a variety of things in our society, we blame poor people, minority people, and drugs is the same way. It's like if we want to vilify a group, we can't very well say we hate those motherfuckers. We can't do that. Instead, we can say we don't like some activity that they're doing, and we tell people we got a war on drugs. Not a war on black people, not a war on Latino people. We have a war on drugs, but in effect, it functions as a war on those folks. That's just one of the aspects of this. I mean, you know, there are all kinds of things, there are all kinds of sort of points that can be made. I mean, people sacrificing their liberty, sacrificing their sort of desire or right to alter their consciousness, to enjoy themselves. There's all kinds of rights people have given up in the process of going after certain groups.
Okay, and so let's sort of like cross that bridge over to the more sort of clinical one, which is when we talk about addiction. You argue that our understanding of addiction is completely wrong.
Yeah, so in this book, in the prologue, one of the things I try to do, I tell people, I take addiction off the table, because whenever you have a conversation about drugs in this country, a trick is to throw you in the addiction camp. Now, addiction represents a small percentage of drug effects, small percentage, vast majority of the people who use these drugs won't experience any problems like addiction. But yet the disproportionate amount of attention is focused on addiction. It's like, for example, if you were interested in cars and the only information you could find on cars dealt with car accidents, car crashes. That's ridiculous. But that's what we do with drugs. And so it's true that some people become addicted. But when you know that the majority of users of any drugs don't become addicted, then that tells you you have to look beyond the drugs to figure out what's going on with addiction. And when we think about addiction, there are a number of things that could be going on. Co-occurring psychiatric illnesses, people, they no longer have worth in a society where they had worth, where they had gainful employment. There are all kinds of things that's related to the society is why people are addicted. But like I said in the prologue, I take that off the table because there are far more interesting things when it comes to drugs. I mean, when you think about a drug like MDMA, a drug that could help people to be more empathetic, help people to be more open, produces euphoria, people feel good, happiness, pleasure, you're going to treat people better. Why are we talking about a car crash when you have all of these positive things here?
Did you in your research find that any particular drugs were maybe more prone to addiction than others? I mean, I know that you're trying to adjust the conversation about addiction to a more wholesale or holistic like zoomed out view. But did you find that there were any differences in, say, MDMA and other drugs that you might have been working with?
Yeah, you know, so there's a caveat. Some drugs are legal and some drugs are illegal. And so to compare them sometimes might be like comparing apples and oranges. So with that caveat in mind, the drug that's the most addictive is tobacco. A third of the users who use tobacco will become addicted. When it comes to heroin, about a quarter to 30% will become addicted. When it comes to something like cocaine, about 15 to 20%. Alcohol is about the same range. Cannabis, about 10%. So that's the best available information we have now in terms of who becomes addicted and who won't become addicted.
And what do we have a sense? I mean, I, you know, and I don't want to focus too much on the idea of addiction because that's the point. But I mean, this is sort of the I guess the part that makes what your writing somewhat controversial is this notion that it is too facile to sort of ignore the addiction aspects of it. I mean, I happen to believe that we should, at the very least, decriminalize and probably legalize the vast majority of drugs. I mean, I don't know that I know enough about drugs per se, but that the issue is, I mean, if you have a third, like a 30% addiction rate for heroin, isn't also part of the calculus is the implications of that addiction? Because certainly with car crashes, I mean, that's also part of it is as well, right? I mean, we're calculating what the cost benefit analysis is on a societal level. And it's not just a function of that there are accidents. It's what is the knock on impact of that?
Okay, there were so many flawed assumptions with that statement, right? So when you say we are calculating this based on risk benefit analysis, we're not. Let's go back. When we think about why drugs are banned in this country, drugs are banned in this country not because of back calculation, not because of pharmacology. Drugs are banned because of racism. So that's how it happened. That's how we ban drugs. That's number one. And then number two, if we think about car crashes, every year, 40,000 Americans lose their life because of car crashes. Nobody's talking about banning cars. We don't even have that conversation because it would be ridiculous. Instead, what we do is we say, how do we make this activity more safe? Seatbelts, speed limits, make sure people can drive, all of those kinds of things. Whereas with drugs, it's off the table. And then when you think about, let's think about guns versus drugs. Now, guns, which I am a supporter of the Second Amendment, right? But let's not forget, guns are designed to kill people. Drugs are not. In fact, drugs are designed to bring people pleasure. Drugs are banned. Guns are not. Every year in this country, we lose 40,000 Americans because of gun-related deaths. I know two-thirds of those are because of suicide, so I just want people to know that most of those are suicide, but still, we lose people because of gun-related deaths. Instead, what we're talking about in terms of gun control is how do we make this activity more safe? How do we think about background checks? How do we think about other sort of checks? And I think that's a reasonable thing to do. Why in the hell are we banning drugs? That's the question. But it's not because of that calculus that you laid out. That's what people say, but that's bullshit. Another thing, too, is that when people say that I ignore addiction, again, bullshit. I spent 30 years studying drugs to try to help people to understand drugs, to try to help people to get off drugs, to deal with their addiction. I spent my life studying addiction. Frankly, it's boring compared to the rest of these things that I'm talking about. And we kind of know what works with addiction, but we haven't been willing to put in the resources, the efforts, and so forth. What works is that you make sure people have a psychologist, make sure they have a physician, make sure they have a social worker, make sure they have other healthcare professionals as a part of that research team, make sure they're gainfully employed, educated. All that works for addiction. But we don't want to do that. Instead, we want to say people like me ignore addiction. No, I'm trying to help you get your freedom is what I'm doing.
Well, to use your car analogy, right? It's like a seatbelt situation, right? I mean, like in Europe, they have drug injection sites or drug consumption sites. I mean, did that factor into your research at all? Because that created, you know, from my understanding, a way safer way to consume substances in some of these countries in Europe, where needles were clean, there was supervision on site, and it's a very different way to look at it. As opposed to what the U.S. does. I mean, Portugal is an example going back decades.
Well, you said you got a number of things there. So you're talking about injection sites. You're talking about Portugal that's decriminalized all drugs. And then you think about Switzerland, where they have treatments where they actually give people heroin as a part of that treatment. So you have a wide range of things going on. So let's start with the injection sites. So injection sites, or they call them supervised consumption facilities. In these places, people can go and take their drugs and use in a clean place. And typically the place is staffed by nurses or something. And so you can get information. Now, think about this. If you have a drug like heroin, MDMA, cocaine, what have you, now you're going to go to a facility with strangers to get right, get your head right. I know I wouldn't want to do that. I mean, I have a home. I would much rather chill with my loved one and do this sort of thing. So the people who are frequenting these here consumption facilities are people who are homeless, people who don't have stable housing. And so if a society really cared about those people, they make sure they have housing. And so those safe consumption facilities have been kind of put off as progressive facilities, and liberals pat themselves on the back because of that. Make sure people have housing, and then we'll pat you on the back. You know, so that's what I advocate for, the housing first, so people can get high in their own space, like you would like to do, like I would like to do. But now let's think about what happens in Switzerland in terms of their treatment of heroin for some of the heroin addicted people. They come to a clinic twice a day, every day. They get doses of heroin, sometimes up to a gram of heroin. And they have a social worker. They have a psychologist. They have a psychiatrist. They have an internist. They have nurses. They have all of these people as part of their treatment team. And you know what? They all have housing, and many of them have jobs because it's Switzerland, and people are happy. And these folks are scheduled in these places to come starting in the 7 o'clock hour in the morning and 5 o'clock hour in the evening. And you know, the patients are on time like Swiss watches. They are responsible. And so these programs really work when you have these adjunctive therapies like talk therapy and the rest of these things. And you're also treating their psychiatric illnesses, and you're treating the whole person. We don't have that kind of commitment in the United States, in part because the people who we see as addicts are not the people who we think of as ourselves. Whereas in Switzerland, it's a homogenous society, and they see everyone as their brothers and sisters.
What? So, so I get the dynamic of addiction is to the extent that it's a problem with certain types of drugs, it's like any other problem that we have with other things in society. We figure out ways of dealing with it, and we come to some agreement on what you know, how much it's worth it. I mean, we're going through this on some level with COVID right now, right? I mean,
That's right.
Similar determination as to how much risk as a society we're willing to accept. And sometimes it takes a while to find that medium. And if I understand the premise here, that calculation has been twisted in the context of drugs, because drugs has been a proxy for, or the demonization of drugs has been a proxy for really a lot of racist attitudes and the way that we've been using that. So, but what do we do? The idea that we need to basically provide for our citizens, broadly speaking, we also have this problem when it comes to education, right? We expect education to make up for these deficits and whatnot. So how do you sequence this, right? Like, I mean, what's the best sequencing for this as a society to move forward?
Okay, so our founding document is kind of a nice group blueprint. But the problem is that they make you read that shit when you're in grade school. So when you become an adult, you don't know what the Declaration says. It's a short, simple document. But the ideals that are, or the promise that's guaranteed to American citizens is profound. Each of us are guaranteed life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, so long as we don't prevent anybody else from pursuing their rights. That means that we can live our life as we see fit. And in like the second or third sentence, it says government should be created to secure these rights, not restrict them. That's profound. So if we just simply live up to that, that's a blueprint. And so like when we see somebody or somebody is using a drug and so forth and they're happy, they're not bothering anybody. Why do I care? Why do you care? What is it about you why do you care if that person is trying to be happy? And that's one of the things that we can look at. But when we do that, what we start to see is like things like the war on drugs, for example. It's not really about protecting people. That's not what this is about. We think about what happened to American factories beginning in the late 70s and continuing. They moved, they left the Rust Belt, they went to countries for cheaper labor. You have to replace those jobs. People, and we replaced them with the war on drugs. The war on drugs is now like one of our biggest jobs programs. That's the real function of the war on drugs. And so when people start to recognize what's going on and why these things happen, we pretend we have a war on drugs to protect me. Really? You put cops in the Black community to protect me? Really? That's bullshit. But people have bought it. And so I'm trying to help people to understand that you deserve the right to behave and live your life as you see fit, so long as you don't bother other people. So people sometimes say, well, what about the vaccine, COVID? Are you arguing that people have the right not to be vaccinated? No. I mean, we all are impacted. If, for example, if I get COVID, I'm preventing other people from enjoying their rights. I don't have the right to do that. So I have to make sure that I'm a responsible person. And part of that responsibility is getting vaccinated. So I am not preventing other people from enjoying their rights. And that's paramount in this equation. And if people would just think about it like that, it becomes very simple.
I'm sorry, because I mean, I guess my dilemma is a little bit is, I mean, I agree with your prescription, but the issue of the sort of the liberty, it seems like that's a little bit more tenuous insofar as that, I mean, we know, right, that we're looking at a massive epidemic of, if you want to call it, opioid epidemic, in terms of like overdose and usage. It's really a little bit more complicated in terms of the substances that are being ingested. But we also know this is incredibly expensive for municipalities and counties and states in terms of providing services for those folks and helping those folks. I mean, so it has the same implications for our community. When Switzerland provides those services, they're doing it through a societal mechanism that is, you know, at odds with the idea. Like it's not just a question of like, you know, what you do just impacts you, because if 3 out of 10 folks are going to get addicted to a substance, and how you measure that in terms of like what their impact is on society, we as a society have to provide some services.
All right. So let's unpack that a bit. So we have opioids on the one hand, the expense to municipalities on the other hand. So we have, let's take the opioid thing, for example. All right. So the way the media, as I laid out in the book, the way the media reports about the opioid crisis is it's criminal. So you see the big number, 80,000 Americans die because of a drug overdose. And then they quickly mention opioids. So in the American mind, the pairing is overdose opioids. But then when you go in the number, an opioid was in the system of maybe 40, 45,000 of those people who died of an opioid. That when you go inside the numbers. And then when you go inside the numbers even further, what you discover is that the vast majority of those people who die from an overdose had multiple drugs on board, and we can't tell what drug is responsible. What we do know is when you take an opioid with another sedative, for example, like alcohol or lots of alcohol, benzodiazepine like Xanax, or an older antihistamine like promethazine, what we know is that you increase the likelihood of respiratory depression. So what you do is you have this massive campaign, education campaign. If you're going to use an opioid or these other sedatives, don't combine these medications because it increases the rate of or the potential for a suicide. And we also know a large percentage of these people, it increases the rate of overdose. We know a large percentage of these people are commit suicide. Another thing that we know is that a large percentage of these deaths are caused by tainted drugs. For example, somebody might think that they had heroin or oxycodone, and they actually had fentanyl, which is much more potent. And if you don't know you're taking fentanyl, you can increase the likelihood of overdosing. That's an easy fix. You can have these facilities that they have in Europe and Colombia, they call drug checking facilities. You can check and see what the chemical composition of the drug that you have. You can, if we simply implemented those drug checking facilities, we would save tens of thousands of lives every year. Everyone knows it, and we haven't done it. Now let's talk about the money that the municipalities have to spend or would spend. Now, if you do like the Swiss and you make sure that your citizens are healthy, happy, they will be productive. The majority of the people in these heroin clinics also work. They are contributing to the tax base. And people want to work because work gives them a sense of worth. And we pretend in this country that it's that people don't want to work. But you have to take care of people. You have to make sure that you have gainful employment, employment that makes them feel worthy. And so my proposal is that you will actually save money and you will also have a happier society.
So with these treatments, I mean, I guess I agree with that. I guess my question has to do with the principle, the sort of the libertarian principle that, you know, what I do doesn't impact.
Hold up. This is not a libertarian principle that I'm espousing. This is an American principle. It's the first one laid out in our founding document. So it's amazing to me that people have sacrificed this important thing, or we put it in a libertarian camp. I think what I do impacts other people. And so it's incumbent upon me to constantly check my behavior, to constantly make sure that I'm not negatively impacting others, to make sure that I'm not preventing others from enjoying their rights. So this ain't a libertarian thing. This is an American thing. This is an American principle. And it's not that complicated.
So, I mean, I think you're showing a significant amount of faith in the American populace. If this information was provided and if these services were provided, you know, this vision would be realized. And I think a lot of that's compelling, right? I mean, when talking about the war on drugs as a racial issue, as opposed to one that makes sense, you have like me completely on board there. My question would be just, would you be in favor of, if there were criminal elements or if there were harms to society that were caused potentially by people falling through the cracks in terms of addiction, that you would be fine with whatever the secondary causal element is, right? Say someone committed a crime due to trying to access drugs. You were say, fine, deal with it like that, but don't deal with criminalizing the addiction element in and of itself.
That's right. We think about alcohol. There are people in our country who get in trouble with alcohol, that every day it happens and we just deal with it. We don't get crazy. We don't act like it's some thing that we haven't seen before. There are people who get in trouble on the highways every day. We just deal with it. The same is true with heroin. But you provide people with the best available information and you allow adults to be adults. The thing that amazes me is that, for one, there are Americans who think they know what's best for other adult Americans. Blows my mind. I don't know what's best for you, and I won't suppose I do. All I ask of you is to be a responsible adult. When you're not being responsible, there are consequences. We have laws in place. We have all of these things already in place. And so this notion that we should tell other adults how to live their life, that's un-American, as long as they're not bothering other people.
And what about what's your position on something like nicotine? I mean, you mentioned, what are the implications for that? Like, to what extent can we restrict something like nicotine, let's say?
Yeah. So like one of the things that happens with tobacco and nicotine is that Americans conflate the issue. You know, my PhD dissertation was on nicotine, so I know this really well. So we knew tobacco smoke caused cancer as early as 1959. But the tobacco industry came in and said, hey, we're opening up this tobacco research council and we're going to find out for you, even though they already knew. And it was really a PR firm with lawyers and so forth. And that went on for decades of them gaslighting the American public. And then in the 90s, we realized how badly we had been gaslit by the tobacco industry. And so Americans are upset with the tobacco companies and so forth, as well they should. But that's because of the tobacco company's deception. They deserve to have the wrath of the American people aimed at them. But when we think about tobacco and nicotine, Americans should be free to engage it with that substance as they see fit. Those are separate issues. But oftentimes what we do is we conflate the two as if they're the same. And they're not. They're different issues.
And so you would apply the same kind of critique, which I would, I guess, to modern big pharma, who's also being deceptive about, I guess, what even is in or what the purposes of the drugs that they're producing are.
Absolutely. Now we're talking about capitalism. So we have allowed companies, whether it's Nike, whether it's Big Pharma, whoever, they are manipulating the public in order to sell their product. Now, if we want to rein that in, we have to think about the way our capitalism functions. We have to think about the sort of restrictions or not restrictions that we place on these folks, a different sort of phenomenon. And I am certainly all about protecting the consumer, making sure that people have the best available information so they can make an informed decision. When the companies violate that principle, there should be consequences. Absolutely.
And how much do we know about all of these substances that we've kept illicit for so many years? I mean, obviously you study their impact on the brain, but I mean, have we had the opportunity? To be honest with you, like I could ask this question about foods. Frankly, I'm not even sure how much research we have done. I just presume we have, but I know that it's been harder to do this type of research because these drugs are illicit. And so, I mean, how much research do you think there has to be done or has been done on drugs? Just broadly speaking.
So when we think about the drugs that people really seek, heroin, cocaine, amphetamines like methamphetamine, MDMA, you think about cannabis, you think about those drugs, we have a ton of information on those drugs. I mean, in places like Colombia, where I'm at, Every year we give thousands of doses of these drugs to people and carefully study their effects. We wouldn't be able to do that if these drugs were as dangerous as the public believes they are. We do this because of the American American taxpayer. We use that money as part for grants and so forth. And so we know a tremendous amount. Just think about this. Our military, our presidents in the past, have taken amphetamines on a regular basis and without incident in order to be alert. We think about something like heroin. Heroin is essentially the same drug as morphine. It just has an acetyl group attached to it, an acid group, and that group doesn't do anything pharmacologically. So the effect of heroin is really morphine. Morphine is a medicine that we use in the treatment of cancer, pain. Heroin is an improved pain reliever in Europe. And so we know a tremendous amount about this, these drugs, MDMA. We're now seeing that is an effective treatment for PTSD. We know a tremendous amount about dosing, how to keep people safe, routes of administration. We know a ton when it comes to these drugs. Trust me, I've been doing this work for 30 years. I wouldn't be taking this position. You know, I'm 54. I'm getting close to retirement. I had a stellar career. Why in the hell would I be putting myself out like this if I really didn't believe this? I mean, I'm tenured. I could go away and shut the fuck up and collect my paycheck and I'm good. My family's good and so forth. So I am staking my reputation on this because it's the right thing to do.
And are there drugs that you think that are out there that we have we don't appreciate the dangers? I'm thinking of like maybe benzos that are maybe, you know, that are prescribed on a regular basis, but we don't necessarily appreciate the potential dangers with those.
So in medicine, one of the things we look at is the risk to benefit ratio. And so when you think about benzos, just like with any drug, we have that calculation. Benzos, there's a potential harm. For example, people can get in trouble because they're sleepy or drowsy and they have an accident or what have you. Or there might be some memory sort of issues going on with some benzos. But the benefits outweigh the risk. And so when we take something like caffeine in the morning, you have to be up. And so you say, I know if I do this on a regular basis, I run the risk of having that withdrawal headache, which is awful. But the benefits will outweigh the risk. And so life is not without risk. We make these risk to benefit calculations throughout the day, every day. And so people, if you're looking for a life without risk, I will show you one of the most boring sort of endeavors that you want to ever see. And so you just have to deal with risk. That's what being an adult is all about.
You mentioned the racist elements of the war on drugs. What I keep coming back to is, I guess, yeah, U.S. paternalism, and I don't know if that's central to your critique, and not paternalism in the imagined way of, you know, what libertarians, I think, would say, right? Or like, you know, the conservative part, you know, the Republican Party now about how the Democrats are trying to control your life. But that does seem to be central to, I guess, your belief here and your critique. So can you expand on that, not just the racial element of the war on drugs?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, in the book, I talk about this sort of infantilizing of Americans. And so I don't want to be treated like a child. And that's how we're being treated. Like, I don't want people to tell me what I can put in my body as long as I'm not bothering anyone else. Of course, that's the major caveat. But we, as I was trying to point out, we seem to think that there are groups of people in our country
that needs to be told how to live their life. Now, and then people say they put it, we put them in these lofty terms, like, what about those people who are vulnerable? We say things like that. And then we talk about communities that are vulnerable. Really, if you cared about those communities that are vulnerable, the first thing you do is make sure they have proper education, gainful employment. You do that. I assure you, those communities will be fine. And so our sort of infantilizing is a smokescreen not to really put in place the social safety nets and also the sort of services that people need in order to thrive in a society. But it's just infantilizing.
Are you encouraged at all by, you know, what's happened in terms of the legalization of cannabis in this country? I mean, things have moved. I think, like I say, I think the last time you were on more than half a dozen years ago, things have moved quite a bit in that time. And it seems to be accelerating at a fairly significant pace, despite the fact that apparently President Biden is really still adamantly against it, even though it's getting legalized in all the major states around the country. But are you encouraged at all by this, or do you think that it's sort of there's a little bit of air left let out of the tire, but it's not really, you know, they're not looking at the full spectrum?
I am encouraged. You know, there are a number of states, the growing number of states that have legalized marijuana for adult use. That's very encouraging. But the reason why they're legalizing marijuana is not so much for people's rights or for justice. It's happening because of the eye on the tax revenue that cannabis is generating. That's the main reason this is happening. That's cool. As long as it's happening, I'm encouraged also by Oregon, who decriminalized all drugs this past November. Decriminalization, although I'm aware that decriminalization has its limitations. For example, decriminalization means that people won't be arrested for possession. That's the spirit of that law. But it does nothing for dealing with drug-related overdoses. So it doesn't do anything to make sure people are not consuming tainted drugs. And that's a concern that I have. And decriminalization also, sometimes when you have racially diverse populations, like, for example, Baltimore, where they decriminalized marijuana in 2014. Between 2015 and 2017, they had 1,500 arrests for marijuana possession. 96% of those were Black people. Black people only represent 60% of Baltimoreans. And so police still had too much discretion under the decriminalization laws. And when you have a racially diverse population, I really worry about police population, police interactions with Black and brown people.
Well, it's fascinating stuff. The book is Drug Use for Grown-Ups: Chasing Liberty in the Land of Fear. Dr. Carl Hart, we will put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and we will be back in just a moment. Oh, well, you're back. I don't know. Should we play this clip of Donald Trump, pushing the vaccine? I thought that was kind of sort of shocking, sure. All things considered. I don't know if we have time for this clip. In fact, I don't think we do. But we'll play that in the fun half. Donald Trump, of course, critiquing why they paused the Johnson & Johnson vaccine after a guy who hid the fact that he had been vaccinated himself when he was president.
Public health is a tricky subject, folks.
Sometimes you want to do it, sometimes you don't. But I mean, the pausing of the J&J is another one of those things where it's sort of these public health questions can be tricky, and I think
Donald Trump's dealing with that complexity.
Well, I don't think he is dealing with that complexity, but I was actually sort of circling back to our guest, Carl Hart. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that our war on drugs and broadly speaking, have been a mechanism in which to control marginalized populations in this country, and we see the disparity all the time in these things. And I think it's a good thing to destigmatize drug use and center it in many respects in, where the context in which people find themselves, in which they start to take drugs. And I would love a society that legalized these things and then provided the social services for that percentage of people who it ends up being problematic for. But
yeah, I mean, I wish I thought of this during the interview, but I would have loved to ask him about what he thinks if he thinks some of these attitudes are rooted in like just religious Puritan kind of old school ways of thinking in the United States, and why it hasn't taken hold in European countries where they've had more progressive solutions to drug use. I mean, there's a lot of these factors here.
They're still really anti-pot, though, in Europe.
It depends on, right?
I mean, I guess it's been a while since I've been over there, but my experience was like Amsterdam was pretty much the only place where it was legal. Maybe it's different now.
Well, yeah, I mean, we've had a big sort of shift in this country over the past half a dozen years or so.
Yeah. My understanding, though, at least in Portugal, they've decriminalized drug use and they.
Right.
It's a longer conversation. But.
Well, folks, sadly, we're out of time for that conversation. Emma and I will be back tomorrow. And for those of you sticking around, we are back now. In fact, we never even left.
Back like we never left.
Back like we never left. We will play that clip of Donald Trump on Sean Hannity. We got a lot of stuff that. Jeez, they brought back Eric Cantor, too.
I know.
It really is an unbelievable reformation process here that's going on.
It's like the Backstreet Boy reunion tour.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what, I guess so, but like were the Backstreet Boys sort of, were they replaced by another set of Backstreet Boys who were...
No, but I mean, One Direction, like they had to make themselves, do you know who One Direction is?
Those like the New Kids on the Block?
Exactly.
I don't know. It's... we'll talk about Mike Lindell too. We got an email from a listener who he said he was driving in his car and he heard our what we were talking about with the Be Frank or whatever it is, Talk Frank.
Mm-hmm.
And he pulled over the car. I guess he's a tech guy, and he said he hacked into their site and got a VIP membership without having to pay for it like in 30 seconds he's tweeted it out. We'll talk more about that in a bit. Just a reminder, folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can become a member by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. when you do, you support the free show, you get it free of commercials, although you do want to avail yourself of that 30% off at sunsetlakecbds.com. Use the coupon code 420. You got three more days for that. 30% off of everything. And maybe if I hear from them that enough people have bought the CBD dog biscuits, mm-hmm. maybe we'll do like a dog biscuit challenge. I'm not going to eat the whole thing, but I'll take another bite on
air. Okay, I
thought
you were trying to rope me into this. It's just like not happening.
Well, maybe. Maybe no. That's the next step.
No, but, that's not a condition of my employment.
It's just it's your support that makes this show possible. Become a member today at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And today on Nomi's show, Nomi will tell us who's going to be on.
Oh, hey. Hi. Hello, everybody. We're doing a special 420 show. It's going to be really fun. Napoleon DeLegend's going to be on. Ben Dixon might have one extra special guest. We're still trying to confirm. You know, this is what happens when you do a daily show. Sometimes things pop up. But yeah, it'll be a great show. Really fun. 420. Also offering a CBD offer. Let's see. Do we need to have like a dog biscuit challenge? Because I already gave CBD to my dog and it knocked because he had a cone on for 4 months. Four months because he kept biting his tail because he's a nervous wreck because of COVID. I think it like all these things happen. So now he's getting the CBD biscuits.
Well, change in scenery, right?
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, yeah. I guess that's true. Have you tried the CBD? Have you tried the dog biscuits?
Not yet. I mean, they just came out, but we're gonna test it out and see if human CBD is better than dog. You want me to try the biscuit?
I kept Sam talking about the pumpkin and the. I don't have a dog.
I have a funny. So my dad, when he was in college, he and his brother were in law school together, and they used to have these big parties, and they would hand out dog food to people and be like biscuits, dog biscuits, and people would eat them because they were crazy because they were probably on cannabis.
Well, I had to eat a dog biscuit once when I was at a bar. They had this big wheel that they'd be like, you want to spin the wheel? You can like win a free drink or something. But there are also bad things on there. And I got eat a dog biscuit. And I was like, I'm not doing that. And they're like, you have to. So they're not that tasty, Sam.
You weren't tricked. These are like 1979 dog biscuits. So I'm pretty sure they were nothing like the ones you're eating, Sam.
I mean, it's just peanut butter and pumpkin and oat.
And CBD.
Uh-huh. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Leckian media universe?
Matt.
Oh, yeah. this is very characteristic for this day, but I'm actually... we have Wes Cheek. No, that's we're going to save that for members. So I'm not actually... I can't remember who we have on this Thursday.
Wait a minute.
But check it out.
Something's wrong.
What was that play again? I was talking over. Pause button.
Wait a minute. Pause. Hit the pause button. Something's wrong.
Oh, that's Brent.
That's good. That's good. So you don't know who's going to be on your show, Matt.
No, but this Sunday for members, Wes Cheek, we're going to be talking about disaster capitalism. So members will look forward to that. And we also did a think tank for patrons on Sunday where we talked about Joe Rogan apparently having no idea that people got COVID relief checks and being really upset about it when Dan Crenshaw told him that people got it, that even if you didn't lose your job, you got a check. So Joe Rogan still sucks. You can hear that on the Patreon episode, think tank. Patreon Left Reckoning, patreon.com/Left Reckoning.
Careful, he's gonna do a segment on you and call you that guy.
I don't even know if he's self-aware.
Bring it, Rogan.
No, he did it last time when we talked about him, he called me that woman. I was like,
oh,
like, at least say my name so I get the clicks, okay?
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah. But Sam,
girl is actually sort of, you know.
You said girl, she said woman.
No, I'm saying girl is the Marlo Thomas show.
Oh. Also, Nando Vila will be on to talk about the Super League Soccer thing on Thursday night.
I didn't know when the IMer wrote in because I just really don't know enough about soccer / football, but that is incredibly messed
up. Yeah, it's
up.
A mess.
It's crazy.
Hey.
It's awful.
All right, we're going to head into the fun app. Folks, hit the like and subscribe, for gosh sakes. Let's do this. Somebody just IM'd me to remind me to do that. And poggers, and see you in the fun half. Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous. You're a little bit upset. You're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America. You. Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me...
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.